And this is KPCW. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Tuesday, May 13th. 40 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. 51 degrees in the Heber Valley under mostly sunny skies, but things will be changing. Here's meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Good morning, KPCW listeners. Here's a look at your forecast for your Tuesday across the Wasatch Back. We're going to be looking at periods of scattered showers developing, especially as we get towards the midday and afternoon hours. Temperatures will be much cooler today. We're looking at high temperatures as you get towards Park City, only in the low to mid 50s this afternoon, with high temperatures only around 60 degrees for the Heber Valley. Again, we'll have those scattered showers and maybe an isolated rumble of thunder as we go throughout the afternoon hours. We'll continue that chance of scattered showers and storms into tonight, but of course colder air will be working its way in. So yes, there could be a couple of high mountain snow showers developing as well, as overnight lows drop down to right around freezing, with that chance of scattered showers continuing through the overnight hours. As we go into your forecast for your Wednesday, look for highs only in the mid 40s for Park City, with highs only in the mid 50s as we get towards the Heber Valley. Again, we're going to continue with that chance of off and on scattered showers and rumbles of thunder as we go throughout the day. So a much cooler stretch of weather with active weather continuing both for your Tuesday and for your Wednesday afternoon. As we get into your Thursday, we'll continue that chance of scattered showers Thursday morning. Once again, overnight lows will drop down close to freezing. So yes, could have a snow shower or two mixed in. Otherwise, as we go throughout the afternoon, we're slightly warmer with highs back into the low 50s in Park City, with highs in the upper 50s for the Heber Valley, still well below average for this time of the year. And then as we get into the end of the week, we get a brief break from the active weather as we get towards your Friday, with partly to mostly cloudy skies. Highs will warm back into the 50s in Park City, and we'll be back in the 60s here in the Heber Valley. But as we go into the weekend, another active weather pattern moves our way, with temperatures starting to cool back down and a chance of more scattered showers and thunderstorms developing across the region as we go into the weekend, as the active weather pattern will continue across the area. But again, as we go into the next couple of days, look for cooler weather with unsettled conditions, highs well below average, with chances of scattered showers and rumbles of thunder expected across the area. From the ABC Forecast Center, I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
It's 8:08. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Shane Scott, taking a look at the agenda for Wednesday's county council meeting. I'll be talking with the new interim Hideout Mayor, Ralph Severini, talking about the job going forward and what's going on in Hideout. And from the People's Health Clinic, CEO Mari Lining calling in with an update on how patients are being affected by federal policy changes. Well, for a decade now, Park City High School's Bright Futures has invited first-generation college students to apply for a multi-year program that helps students through the challenges to get to graduation day. But a disagreement between program founders and the Park City Education Foundation has led to resignations, as well as donor funds being withheld. Bright Futures celebrated the 10th anniversary of its formation last fall. Since the formal launch in 2016, the program's been administered through the Park City Education Foundation. Private donors help raise hundreds of thousands of dollars to run the program each year. To date, more than 170 Park City High School students have been involved in the Bright Futures program. By the end of this year, 25 of them will have graduated from college. Foundation CEO Ingrid Whitley says the changes to Bright Futures program are the results of a recent strategic planning process undertaken by the staff and the board of the Ed Foundation.
We went through a strategic planning process with our board of directors this year and evaluated, you know, everything that we've been working on for the last 5 or 6 years. Bright Futures is one of those programs, and we have a core value of equity and inclusion. And one of the things that we discussed was not every first-gen student is getting support currently from the way the program is structured. And so next year, we're going to be funding a position in the high school who will be working with every first-gen student, starting in ninth grade, all the way through senior year.
But one of the major donors of the program, Tommy Tanzer, is upset. He's critical of the new direction, saying the foundation's board doesn't understand the program's needs. The founding sponsors of Bright Futures sent a letter to the foundation board saying that they were dismayed that they were not included in the strategic discussions about the future of the program. They say their historical knowledge could have been helpful. Tanzer's concerned that the program is getting dismantled from its original purpose.
The people that ran the program, the founders, the people who are in the program that were paid employees, have all quit. They've driven away every one of the founders except for two. They've forced or had a resignation of the two people who've run the program. They've forced the resignation of the people who were interacting with the students at the college. And they've driven off all the volunteers.
But Whitley believes the new program will be better than ever. She says it'll be more inclusive and have more student participation. It will be expanded to include every first-generation student to benefit from Bright Futures.
We're excited to be able to create some efficiencies, just working better with the school district, partnering with them on things that they're already offering. And that enables us to be more creative with how, again, we're leaning in with support from a financial perspective.
Former Park City Board of Education member and Bright Futures financial supporter Mo Hickey told KPCW the original sponsors are concerned that the program's getting watered down and does not reflect the original intent of Bright Futures. The premise of the program, he says, was to focus on the students with high aspirations and who self-selected to join the program. It was more about than just getting good grades.
These changes started being rumored. It was concerning because, again, we do have programs that could support that community. But this was a different type of program. I'm just concerned that when you take a program that's so very specific and then you try to broaden it, you're probably going to diminish the overall result.
Tanzer believes the foundation is attempting to add Bright Futures' substantial financial resources, nearly $2 million, to its general operating fund, while planning to curtail the historic activities that have supported the students in the program. The letter from the sponsors says the new program, quote, is not the program to which donors have contributed more than $3 million since the program's inception. Using these monies for any purpose other than funding the Bright Futures program under its current specific mission would be viewed as Park City Education Foundation acting in bad faith by the founders and other donors, the letter goes on to say, who have restricted their gifts to Bright Futures. Jennifer Bello, Vice President of Advancement for the Education Foundation, told KPCW that's inaccurate and all Bright Futures restricted funds only go to Bright Futures. Tanzer says he's resigned from the committee and rescinded his six-figure legacy gift and has requested a refund of his past donations. He's urging the community to join him in demanding the school board and state of Utah audit the foundation's fundraising, spending, and administrative practices. The Bright Futures program, he says, represents a decade of his life's work, and he says he won't stand by as it's being dismantled. Tanzer has developed a website which he says documents the complete story of Bright Futures success. That link can be found online at kpcw.org. Well, the Summit County Council meets at 4 o'clock at the Richens Building Auditorium on Wednesday. In the studio with a preview of the meeting, Summit County Manager Shane Scott. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Up first is a discussion and possible action on a request by Summit County Lands and Natural Resources Department for an extension of time to use RAP tax recreation grant funds awarded to the department in 2023. So why the extension?
There were several tasks that Jess Kirby and the Lands Department was hoping to accomplish with this RAP tax funds, and that she wasn't able to get through all of that. And if you read the staff report, she's got some reasons why there was a delay in conducting the baseline on the 910, which then delayed the range, I think, wildlife and recreation management plans. So there's those three plans that she'd still like to complete. I don't think this is a request that doesn't have some precedent to it. I think there are some understanding by the council. We hate to get any special treatment as a county organization, but I think there's been some other organizations that have had some delays in the past. The council has granted, so we're hoping that they do so in this case as well.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. There is some precedent for the council allowing other organizations outside of the county.
Yes, I think then there's good reasons why this was delayed. We hate delays, but I think it's understandable.
Yeah, how much money are we talking about?
Well, the whole grant was $105,000, so I think it's probably in the $30,000 range, but I can't remember off the top of my head.
Okay, and that money just lives in its own fund?
Yes.
So it's there?
Mm-hmm. Set aside in county coffers.
Okay. Let's see. The restaurant tax, I believe it was the restaurant tax committee, asked to go back and figure out how to divvy up the $85,000 that was awarded to the Sundance Institute, but that funding pulled back after last week's discussion. So where's the money going now?
They did meet, and they did make a decision to not reallocate that to any existing applicants. They just kind of felt like that was unfair and that they made those decisions. So they've asked to roll that those funds over to next year, which will be available to future requesters.
Okay. And I mean, in your opinion, is that a good idea? It kind of sounds like sour grapes, you know, that something that we have paid for and that will bring, butts to seats as the fund promises or requires. will happen anyway. So.
Well, I think the council made some good reasons why they made those decisions. I think that those have some validity. Is there a long-term viability for this organization? There's not not in Utah. So, I think Councilmember Hansen mentioned. Those dollars for marketing along the Wasatch Front, is that really necessary? I think, I don't know about you, Leslie, but anyone that knows that I live up here has asked me about Sundance. I think it's, everybody's well aware of what's going on, that it's the last year, next year. I do appreciate that the committee met and it tried to take a real administrative, we're taking the politics out of this, and they recommended that they fund some, and then the council decided that wasn't necessary. So I think the process worked exactly how it should, and I think both decisions are very valid.
Any thought, though, of doing some kind of send-off to Sundance? I mean, again, certainly we're a little bit sore that they decided not to stay in Utah, but again, they've brought 40 years of... Absolutely. Economic benefit.
Absolutely. I hope it's the best Sundance we ever have. I hope we do. We roll the red carpet out. I hope we show. I mean, if there's, I don't know about you, but I've had an ex-girlfriend that I wanted to show that I wanted to live my best life, and I want to show them what they're missing out on. I think we can do that with Sundance if we show them what a good experience we can have, even in kind of a lame duck year, if you will.
All right, let's see. The council also set to approve the RAP funding for recreation, arts, and parks. Can you refresh us on how much we're talking about and how many organizations?
I believe this one was just about $1.5 million. I believe we are funding 26 organizations out of the 31 that applied. So a lot of good we're doing here. And if folks are interested, there's five that weren't funded. If you read the staff report, there are reasons why each one of those was not funded. And one of those was Sundance, actually, in this crop as well. I can't remember how much they asked for in this one, but the RAP tax committee cited the precedent set by the council with restaurant tax. They mentioned the long-term commitment. They mentioned the concern with meeting reporting requirements. So, is this sour grapes? I don't know, but I think there is. I'm seeing this as these are important funds, and we are trying to focus those on organizations that we know are going to continue and that are local and that are going to get long-term viability here.
So. All right. Let's see. Anything else on the agenda that you wanted to mention?
Well, I'd like to call out the National Public Works Week. I think Public Works. I think I've heard this from a Public Works person in my career years ago, that they feel like they're the redheaded stepchild of fire and police, and they don't feel like they've always get the recognition they deserve, whether it's snow plowing or landfill or stormwater. They do so much. The weeds department. So we're very grateful for them, and we're happy to honor them at the agenda this week.
Okay. All right. Let's see. I wanted to ask you about, because we keep hearing about the potential of perhaps a 40% cut of federal grants being pulled from the Summit County Health Department. Again, we don't really know anything until the end of June. But how would we keep the health department rolling if, in fact, something like that happens?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to look at that. I heard Dr. Phil yesterday with you, our health department director, talking about our priorities, which would be individuals, which would be people. And that means those that work for us, but also means the community. There's community services that we're trying to provide that we will continue to prioritize. The challenging part. I think you and I spoke about this maybe even 6 months ago, that Phil had asked his folks to stop spending anything that wasn't absolutely necessary. So he's already pared back, which is going to make what he called a runway much longer and a softer landing. We do have rainy day funds that we can use. There will probably be proposals that incorporate some of that. Depending on how bad it is, we may have to start talking about how we can lose folks to attrition if that's necessary. How we might provide months of either pay or notice if things, if programs need to go away. So it's really a troubling situation. As you know, there's an economic Wasatch Back Economic Summit that is all day today, and I've never been as excited for an economic summit as I am today. I'd like to hear from those that are presenting, from those that have come here to be our keynote speakers, about how's the current unrest, volatility at the federal level affecting us federally, affecting us statewide, and affecting us along the Wasatch Back. We need to know these things. Are we more insulated than other communities? I think that we are, but what does that mean exactly? And how do we prepare today for probably what's going to happen this summer? So.
Any other federal funding that would affect county operations that you're concerned about?
We remain concerned about federal grants, especially those around the 910 and the Ure Ranch. They seem solid. They seem intact. Until the money's in the coffers and the checks have cleared, I won't feel 100% comfortable. We are making a presentation next month about the ways that federal grants and funding will impact the county or could impact the county. Most of that will be around the health department. We'll probably have Jess Kirby with our Lands and Natural Resources Department come and present as well and discuss some of the volatility around her department. But what we've been really focused on is operations. If a program is cut and we can't do an initiative, whatever that is, that will be a concern. But a bigger concern is going to be those that affect people and people that have been with us for years. We're hoping we can insulate that as best we can.
So this presentation would be at a county council meeting?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Correct.
All right. Let's see. You were there for the opening of the new Trampas Eagle Lily Transit Campus last week. The county, is it the county that's liable for this $43 million of bonding, or maybe explain how that works? I mean, is the High Valley Transit Organization a separate group or like an enterprise fund of the county?
High Valley Transit is a separate group. They are what's called an independent special service district. We have dependent special service districts. Basin Recreation is a dependent. The biggest distinction you can make between an independent and a dependent is not only funding, but the county council serves as Basin Rec as their governing board. So there's still a level of supervision there that the county council makes for Basin Rec, for Park City Fire Department, for North Summit Fire Department. But the High Valley Transit operates independently. The board makes the decisions. The board hires and fires the director. And they are responsible for the funding. So they have their own taxing authority. They have the obviously revenue from certain fees, and they get a lot of grants as well. So that they are on the hook for that. And the county is obviously still involved. We're very involved in BRT, not only from a support level, but also financial support level as well. So there's still ways that we interact, of course. I was there. It was really an exciting day. I think everybody was very excited to see that tent go down. It's got to be one of our small successes over the last couple of years. But very exciting, and the future of High Valley Transit looks very bright.
So you, as county manager, don't need to be worried with flat revenues that, again, because High Valley Transit is paying off this bond with sales tax revenues. So, again, that's something you don't have to lose sleep over if flat revenues are flat over the next several years.
It's not. I mean, that's especially when we have good people in place, and Caroline and her team are outstanding. I do attend most High Valley Transit board meetings. I just, as I'm not a voting member, I'm just a participant, because I do want to know what's going on. And of course, we affect each other. Obviously, we affect each other very in a lot of ways. One of those is as well as we've been helping them with services. They have their own finance director now. They have their own HR now. They still use our legal team. So they've kind of really grown up over the past few years. So there's probably less and less that we're doing together from a supervision perspective. But we're always going to work together in a collaborative manner.
Okay. And any news with regard to the 224 BRT lanes that you're aware of?
No, we've had a kind of community meeting. I think that was this week. I joined that on Zoom. It was well attended. A lot of good questions from the community, and I think that the design is still moving forward.
All right. And any news on whether Dakota Pacific Real Estate has filed its administrative development agreement?
I haven't heard, and maybe I mentioned this last time I was on. We adopted that temporary zoning ordinance, which makes me part of that process, so I've really stayed out of it. I haven't spoken to any members of Dakota Pacific or our staff about that in a couple of weeks, but I'm assuming something's going to come in soon, but I haven't heard for sure.
All right. Anything else you wanted to mention, Shane?
Can I just put in a plug for next week's meeting? I won't be here the Tuesday before, but it's the 21st, and it's we're having 3 hours of interviews for those respondents to the Klein-Dolly RFP. I think there's a lot of members of our community that are interested in that project, and I think it's very exciting. I think we're going to see some really exciting things that will come out of that those interviews, and I think, again, it's 3 hours. I'm sure it's a everyone will be riveted to their computer monitor watching that. But I think it's something to follow, and we'll be I think the council is very excited to see it. So
are those RFPs now public that people can go and read them themselves?
There is some proprietary information in there, so they're not 100% public. But the agenda packet will have a lot of information about each of the presentations, what the highlights are, who they are, their experience, et cetera.
And there were six?
Six respondents.
Okay, right. So everybody gets a half hour.
Yep.
Okay, and then the process for that would be just kind of take it under advisement and then?
Yes, and I think as we meet together as staff and council after those presentations, we're hoping to narrow down this eventually to one respondent that with whom we can negotiate and start to get a contract in place. So that may take a couple of weeks. That may take, like I said, a couple of weeks, but we're hoping that's the next step.
Okay, and this Klein-Dolly parcel will get about 30 acres just I guess west of Jeremy Ranch Elementary.
That's correct.
Okay. Yep. Thanks, Shane.
Okay. Thanks.
That's Summit County Manager Shane Scott. Taking a look at some other local news, a 28-year-old Murray man has been charged with attempted murder in a 2024 Summit County hit and run. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that he is facing 9 similar charges along the Wasatch Front.
Summit County prosecutors charged Andoy Pham with attempted murder May 8th for hitting a woman walking in the Sun Peak neighborhood with his car on March 5th of 2024. She survived the incident but was bruised and had a cut on her head. Court records show Pham is also charged with 9 counts of attempted murder in 6 similar hit and runs across the Salt Lake Valley. All of the 10 attempted murder charges are first-degree felonies. Each carries a maximum prison term of life in prison. Authorities believe he'd been targeting women in crosswalks and along roads at random with his white 1999 Toyota Avalon from August 2023 to March 2024. Court papers in the Summit County case say sheriff deputies used license plate readers and witness testimony to confirm the same vehicle hit the woman at the intersection of Sun Peak Drive and Bear Hollow Drive. One witness told investigators he saw the Avalon leaving the area quickly around the time of the incident. The witness was waiting to turn right from Bear Hollow onto SR 224, and the Avalon passed him on the left to take that right turn, quote, without stopping or looking. Pham was arrested in March of last year and is being held without bail in the Salt Lake County Jail. No trial date has been set in those cases. A no-bail warrant was also issued May 9th by 3rd District Judge Richard Brozick in the Summit County case. The new charging documents state Summit County deputies reviewed Pham's internet search history from February to March of 2024, which included homeless shelters for young women in Utah, mass shooting, Utah hookers, Ted Bundy, the Zodiac Killer, America's serial killers, and murder. Pham's phone data also showed it was in the Sun Peak area when the hit and run happened last March, according to investigators. An initial court appearance at the Silver Summit Justice Center has not been scheduled. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Preliminary data from the National Skier Areas Association indicates that the 2024-25 season saw the second highest visitation on record at U.S. ski areas. A total of 61.5 million skier visits represents a 1.7% increase over the previous season. But according to the National Ski Areas Association, the number trails the record-setting 2022-23 season by 3.9 million visits, or just under 6%. NSAA shared that preliminary season data in a press release yesterday. The post-COVID surge was widely considered an anomaly across the travel and recreation industries here in Utah. That season also coincided with a record-setting snowfall. A skier visit is counted each time an individual uses a lift ticket or pass at a ski area. The current total is still preliminary, as several ski areas, including Snowbird, have extended their seasons. In a prepared statement, NSAA President and CEO Michael Reitzel said the organization set a goal several years ago to reach a three-year rolling average of 60 million skier visits. That benchmark, he says, has now been surpassed. While weather will always be unpredictable, he says this year was less volatile overall, and nearly every region, he says, saw solid snowfall. The 2024-25 season, he adds, may come to represent a new baseline for the industry. Even if normal continues to evolve, he says that this season gives a strong point of reference for what steady, healthy growth looks like. A final number will be released once final numbers are compiled. NSAA has tracked skier visits since the 1978-79 season. The historical visitation data can be found online at kpcw.org. The steering committee for the 2034 Olympic and Paralympic Winter Games in Utah shared updates yesterday on the state's evolving plans for the international event. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
On Monday, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation CEO Colin Hilton discussed the 2034 competition venues, which include several Wasatch Back locations like the Utah Olympic Park, Park City Mountain, Deer Valley Resort, and Soldier Hollow. Hilton was especially excited about Block 85 downtown in Salt Lake City, a new addition from the 2002 Games.
Block 85, which is that big parking lot kitty corner to the Delta Center, will be both the Medals Plaza and a big air competition site, which is pretty cool to bring a mountain sport to the downtown urban environment with a five-story scaffold structure.
Hilton said the state's concept is unprecedented in that all competition venues are within an hour drive from the Athlete Village at the University of Utah.
There's no place on the planet that has it this proximate to the village.
Frazier Bullock, who serves as executive chair and president of the 2034 Games, also outlined various committees that will play a role in the long-term planning strategy. Several Parkites are contributing, including Olympians Lindsey Vonn, Ted Ligety, and Haley Batten, as well as Park City Mayor Nan Worrell and Cloudflare CEO Matthew Prince, who is chair of the Technology and Innovation Committee. Organizing Committee CEO Brad Wilson said the group's efforts will ramp up after the 2028 Summer Games in Los Angeles.
After we get through the LA Games in 28 is when things will start to change very dramatically for us. That's when we can commercialize our games, we can start talking to sponsors, and we will start a lot more in-depth games planning and getting our strategy lined up.
Officials with the 2034 Games, which are privately funded, have set a $300 million fundraising goal. Steve Starks, who is vice chair of the strategy committee, said private donations will allow them to operate without any tax dollars. Starks said it will also help them navigate any economic uncertainty. Bullock said organizers will soon begin reaching out to residents in the venue communities to bring their input into planning at all stages.
Well, one of the things that we're trying to do is really connect around the state with the citizens of Utah. And we want to listen to their ambitions of what they would like to see the games accomplish.
Organizers will also share the state's plans for the games with residents at the listening sessions. Officials said the tour begins in Ogden next week before heading to the Wasatch Back. Listening session dates are expected to be announced over the next week. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
On the phone now with an update from the People's Health Clinic, I have CEO Mari Lining. Good morning, Mari.
Morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for calling in. So we've been talking with county officials about the potential loss of federal funding. Talk a little bit about how your clinic is funding. Are you in danger of losing any funding?
Yes and no. So the People's Health Clinic is a private nonprofit health clinic that does not directly receive federal funding. We are not a federally qualified health center. With that being said, we do receive state funding that comes from federal block grants. So in March, we received an email that suddenly a grant of $27,000 that we'd expected this year and next year had been cut. And actually, a couple weeks ago, we learned that the AmeriCorps program has now been discontinued, and we actually have a really wonderful scholarship recipient who had been planning to start with us in the middle of June. And we're going to hire her anyway as a medical assistant because we've promised her a spot and she's moving here from New York. But, you know, these are unprecedented times. We don't expect things like the AmeriCorps program, which has been around for 30 years, to suddenly get canceled.
And luckily, I guess that's pretty low cost there, because those AmeriCorps, they're basically volunteers, don't get paid a whole lot.
Yeah. It's actually a cost of about $30,000 to us. So, and, you know, adding that all up, we lost $57,000 of expected funding in a two-month period. Yeah. So, you know, this is a time just to really be ready to be adaptable. And we're putting extra efforts into making sure our donors understand that we need sustainable funding.
All right. Now, it sounds like you still have lots of patients coming in despite the change in our immigration policies.
We do, and we've been really relieved about that. The very first week of President Trump's inauguration, we did have a decline in patients, but this is the power of our staff at the People's Health Clinic. Two of my employees who identify as members of the Latina community reached out to our patients to let them know that we're taking all the precautions possible to keep them safe, and that we will certainly let them know as soon as possible if we perceive a risk. And with that messaging, our patients came back. So actually in Q1, we saw more patients than we did first quarter last year. So I'm just happy and, again, relieved that our patients trust us and are coming to seek the medical care that they absolutely need.
Yeah, so besides kind of offering that, I guess, I don't know what you're offering them in terms of just some reassurance that you can help. I mean, is there anything else that you can do to help?
There is. So, you know, one of the key concerns for our patients not coming to appointments is transportation. Even if they have their own transportation, they have been just afraid to drive right now, especially coming from Wasatch to Summit County. And so we've been helping with transportation efforts. We secured funding to be able to get our patients Ubers. So trying to do what we can to mitigate the fear they have in, seeking preventative and also more urgent health care.
Yeah. So why the fear to drive? Just getting pulled over?
Correct. Mm. Just any potential encounter with law enforcement. Also, if you have got undocumented status in Utah, you can actually get a type of a driver's license, but it clearly identifies you as being a non-citizen. So again, people are, really just terrified right now.
All right. Let's talk about some of the implications of a few of the immigration policies that we've seen. One of those is the information sharing being done now by the Internal Revenue Service. Why is this important?
I still can't wrap my mind around the fact that that is happening. But almost all of our patients, our adult patients, pay taxes in good faith with the understanding that if they show that they've been contributing every year, it will help them on their path to citizenship. Historically, information that the IRS has is private for undocumented individuals. And so now that there's data sharing to ICE means that they have a whole profile on the undocumented community, which, you know, it's just really sad. Again, these are individuals who actively contribute to our economy. They're filling all the essential tourism jobs in Park City, paying taxes, and now that could potentially get used against them.
So there are a number of policy changes also with regard to Social Security. What are some of those?
So with Social Security numbers, the Trump administration has basically invalidated numbers that were given to individuals with humanitarian parole. So they had actually obtained legal work authorization in the country under types of impermanent status. And by revoking these Social Security numbers, they've suddenly lost their ability to work legally with the idea idea being that that would force people to self-deport. But again, these individuals who have humanitarian parole have left their countries trying to escape extreme violence and, you know, unsurvivable conditions. And so we have to remember that it is a human right to seek asylum, to seek safety across the border. So again, trying to get these individuals to self-deport back to incredibly unsafe conditions is just wrong.
And we're also seeing deportations without due process across the country. Are we seeing that happen here in Summit and Wasatch County?
I am not aware of any of our patients having been deported without a due process. We have had an individual sent to ICE in Nevada just because he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. He has no criminal history. But I don't know that that's occurred here.
Okay. And certainly there's, I think that's probably what the biggest fear is, right? Just being at the wrong place at the wrong time and some kind of ICE, you know, showing up from ICE?
Yeah, this individual was actually arrested by law enforcement in Wasatch County because he was in a household with an individual that they were looking for, and they couldn't find that individual, so they just took him instead.
All right. And then one other is just mandatory immigrant registration. What's that about?
So that is a Trump policy saying that undocumented immigrants have to register with DHS, provide fingerprints, addresses, and, you know, if you don't register, then that in itself is considered an illegal act. But, you know, people are obviously very scared to register with, you know, Department of Homeland Security, given what's going on. So there's just really been an erosion of trust in public institutions. And, you know, immigrants are afraid that if they provide information that could lead to arrest, you know, as a healthcare provider, that fear makes me worry for public health because this means individuals are not going to seek out services that were previously available. So, for example, we have a number of patients who have mixed status families, and they're not going to want to enroll their children in Medicaid or state CHIP. They won't be bringing kids in to get vaccinations, you know, under those different types of coverage because, again, they're just afraid to be identified.
You also have a new patient advisory committee. What's this?
Oh, I'm really proud of our new patient advisory committee. So, again, one of the strengths of the People's Health Clinic is we have the community voice through our staff represented that helps us drive strategic decision-making. But we've never really had patients at the table. And so this patient advisory committee is literally composed of 10 patients who help us ask the right questions and make the right strategic decisions. What we don't want to do is make decisions for a group of people without hearing what they actually need. And what really surprised me is when we sent out messaging to our patients asking who would want to be involved, we expected, you know, 5 or 10 people to respond, especially given this current political climate. And we actually had 160 people say that they were interested in being on our patient advisory committee. And so that just meant a tremendous amount to us that our patients believe in us and want to be involved.
Wow. Okay. And then finally, save the date for the annual Walk and Wine. When and where is this going to be?
Yeah, our annual Walk and Wine is at Stein Erickson. It is on Sunday, June 22nd. It's a really fun day. It starts out with the choice of a hike or yoga, and then a luncheon with wine at the beautiful Stein Erickson, and then we'll have presentations from a few of our staff members and patients just talking about our mission and helping people understand the importance of having a safety net clinic in Park City.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention, Maury?
No, I appreciate your time and thoughtful questions always, Leslie. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maury. Mari Leining is the CEO of People's Health Clinic. Well, by a 2-1 vote, Hideout Mayor Ralph Severini was elected to serve out the rest of the year for the unexpired term of Phil Rubin, who resigned last month. Ralph joins me on the phone now. Good morning, Ralph. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning.
So tell us why this was something that you wanted to do.
Well, it was, to a large degree, a continuation of what I've already been doing. And if you look at it, I think I've been working for the town of Hideout for the last 8 years, either in roles at the Planning Commission when I was vice chairman, or the town council, which I've been, you know, close to, 5 years now. And this is the third town that I served on. I have two others on the East Coast in similar capacities. So have had a lot of experience going in, both at the government, local government level, as well as my business level. So I thought this would be a good time in my career, so to speak, to move more into a full-time job for the town.
So what do you do for work? What's your background there and experience?
Yeah, I've been an executive across a number of companies over the past 25, 30 years. And currently, for the past 5.5 years, I've been with Amazon Web Services, which is a huge cloud infrastructure company doing things like artificial intelligence. And I probably talked to 150 to 200 executives around the world in the world of financial services and how they can take technology and improve and build and innovate in their business and improve their competitiveness.
Okay, so as kind of part of the deal here, you agreed to run for mayor come November. Has anybody else announced at this point?
I don't know. Well, of course, we haven't announced officially by filing the papers, which are June 2nd through the end of that week. But my plan is to do exactly that. And hopefully, if I win, there will be a further continuation of the efforts that I'm trying to promote, so to speak, and have some consistency from that standpoint. Right now, it was, you know, kind of a month since Mayor Rubin resigned due to his health reasons. And then there was an interim with Chris Beyer, and then now myself for the next 5-6 months. And then we would have the 4-year stint for the next mayor. And that's kind of try to keep some consistency. So I will be running. Don't know who else is going to run exactly on against me.
All right. And how is your council seat now get filled for the rest of the year?
Oh, well, that's similar to filling the mayor seat. It's, from what I know and have read, it's analogous to how the mayor seat gets filled. You've got X number of days, I think 30, to have a meeting and to entertain a new submission for the council seat. And then they would do similar, they would be in a similar position presenting to the town council and then the town council voting.
All right. Well, mayors in this type of government really seem to be just figureheads, right? The shaking the hands, the kissing the babies. It's really the council members who do the debating and voting on the issues. Well, so why was that something you wanted to give up?
Well, I think it was just, as I mentioned earlier, a natural evolution of my commitment to the town. And this is a really great town. I love the views. My wife and I moved here. We have our daughter and her family who lives close by. And I think some of my experience across three towns and the ability to work with trying to get some of the needs for the town fulfilled, including economic and revenue and getting a place to eat and furthering the efforts around Richardson Flat to build out an area where we can have some commercial and retail as well as Ross Creek. I think I've already been doing that, and I'd like to lead that charge. I think the mayor really needs the mayorship, in my opinion. And you're probably right. It's a figurehead oftentimes. But my goal is to be more proactive in terms of getting involved in some of those key activities where, through my own experience worldwide, I can drive some of those initiatives, accelerate some of those initiatives, bring them to hopefully fruition in a better and faster way for the town.
So what are those plans for the unincorporated area of Summit County that is part of that Richardson Flat annexation?
Well, the original, you know, in fact, a number of years ago, back in 2021, I initiated the referendum, which allowed everyone in town to vote in the June 2021 election. So 4 years ago, rather than just the town council. Well, if you remember, the town voted 2-1 and came out quite heavily for that vote. So there were a lot of people who came out 2-1 that they wanted the annexation. Of course, there were some intervening issues and problems across the way, but, you know, it's now come down to where this will move ahead. Now, what the final outcome, meaning the design, the original concept, you know, after 4 years could change, but the fundamentals around some housing and some even low-income housing, as I recall, and commercial will be part of this endeavor. How much flexibility we'll have in any changes on that, we might steer it to more commercial depending on our developer and partner here. So I think that's where, you know, I'll have a lot of involvement. And I started our economic development committee three years back, and that's been focusing on the Ross Creek area as kind of a recreational amenity area with maybe a couple of small restaurants, but something that creates a community center atmosphere. So that's a big initiative as well. So I think Ross Creek serves as really the central part of town, and we want to build that. We want to create a better environment for community interaction at that point. And yeah, it could get out to a building like a community center. So, but we need money. You need money and resources to do that. So you need all these things in combination and tandem to make some of this come to real fruition. And that's where I come into play.
Yeah, you mentioned a developer partner. Are you talking about the original master developer, Bob Martino? Who is this partner that you have?
So if you remember, Nate Brockbank brought the Richardson Flat Silver Meadow annexation to the town with a proposal of, that's a proposal still on the table, and that was approved. But behind Nate and has been is the Larry H. Miller Group. And so, you know, they're one of the stellar, really, companies to work with in the state of Utah. And so I've already talked to some of those folks. You know, they're the same folks that profiled Salt Lake City and were in that CNBC series on the 10 best cities in the United States. So working with them will be a real pleasure, I hope. So.
All right. And what's the latest with the $100 million lawsuit? Again, with the original developer of Hideout, Bob Martino, he was saying that he had about another 1,900 vested residential units. The town planner said that wasn't so. This lawsuit was filed. Has that been resolved?
As far as I know, that's still open. But I would love to have Bob and myself get together and, you know, basically talk through this. I think at this point that suit doesn't serve either party and the town. So I'd rather work together with Bob, and I would love to sit down over dinner with him and see. And actually, you know, he's a visionary founder of our town. I'd like to, you know, profile him a little bit more and what he's done to create our town and hopefully really collaborate and cooperate with all entities. And that's a fundamental principle of what I want to accomplish anyway, and that is building bridges to our surrounding communities. And I've got several ideas on how we'll work together. I'd certainly talked to Nan Worrell in a couple of copies previously. So, you know, there's transportation issues and other things, but I'm thinking bridges to our surrounding communities. And we can use the fire, you know, the wildfire mitigation. Wildfires have no boundaries. So I've got some interesting things that you might be want to follow up on in July, where we'd have the State Insurance Commissioner John Pike, who's going to attend kind of a mini symposium here, which will be cross town. So more collaboration. And I would say with Bob, Mr. Martino, I would say the same thing. Let's collaborate on this rather than and let's resolve some of these kind of issues that have gone on in the past and celebrate what he's done for the town and his vision.
Okay, I got about 30 seconds left, but what about the Golden Eagle development that at one time had more lawsuits against Hideout than homes actually built? Has that been resolved?
There are some areas of resolution that are going on. I'm not sure at the individual level if there are any on that. But again, I think, one of my principles is to eliminate that. Actually, one of the residents up there who hasn't moved in yet and who was helping us on the one of our committees, we've been communicating. Really, it's about communication and trying to understand the position so that, whatever we inherit from Golden Eagle is supportable from an engineering standpoint. So I don't see any of that being unresolvable at all. And I'm going to continue to work to, if there are any unresolved issues in that area, work to try to deal with that without litigation.
Okay, I got to leave it there. Ralph, thanks so much for your time.
Okay.